From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Les Standiford's book about the history of the Charles Dickens story, A Christmas Carol, is called The Man Who Invented Christmas. And of course, before the tale of Ebenezer Scrooge, there was a Christmas. But Standiford says you might not recognize it. In 1843, when the book was published, there were no Christmas cards, no Christmas trees. The story was wildly popular, so popular it changed the way we think of the holiday. Today in the program, Les Standiford is joining us to talk about the story behind the story of A Christmas Carol, where the story came from, and how it revitalized forgotten customs of the holiday, how it gave a secular counterpoint to the story of the Nativity, and how it expressed the essence of Dickens' most passionate beliefs, battling ignorance and want. Join us after the news.
Friend, follow, and join us on social media to stay connected with the latest goings-on. Find out who's on Radio West tomorrow, what's happening on Capitol Hill, and get a glimpse behind the microphones with pictures and videos of station staff and special events. We're on Facebook, Instagram, Tumblr, and Twitter. Search for KUER 90.1.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Writers get ideas from all kinds of places and experiences. Sometimes the stories come fully formed. Some things are traces of a story with just hints at plots and characters. In his book, The Man Who Invented Christmas, the writer Les Standiford explains that for Charles Dickens, his story, A Christmas Carol, came on a long walk in the fall of 1843. He had just given a speech at a critical time in his life. It was a speech where Standiford says he had conveyed the essence of his most passionate beliefs about education and social justice and the importance of the community in sharing the role of caring for the poor. And there would be other long walks where the story would take shape. When it was published, the story of Ebenezer Scrooge and Bob Cratchit and Tiny Tim would change Dickens' life and his work. And not only that, it changed the way the rest of us would come to see or to celebrate the Christmas holiday. Today in the program, we're talking about the story behind the story of A Christmas Carol. Les Standiford is joining us to talk about The Man Who Invented Christmas, how Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol rescued his career and revived our holiday spirits. Les Standiford is a writer, historian, the director of the creative writing program at Florida International University. He's the author of 20 novels and works of nonfiction. The one we're talking about is, as I mentioned, The Man Who Invented Christmas. He's joining us today from a studio in North Palm Beach, Florida. And Les Standiford, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
I wanted to let me mention just this may be a bit of a diversion, but I should mention there's kind of a local twist that you dedicate this book to the Salt Lake City bookseller Sam Weller, who died in 2009. I was kind of interested in that.
He pops up in Dickens' work.
Exactly.
But was a very real Sam Weller for whom I worked at Zion Bookstore while I was in graduate school, the creative writing program, as a matter of fact, at the University of Utah.
Huh. As you point out in the book, there have been a lot of people who have written about those parallels between Dickens' life and his writing. But for some reason you say A Christmas Carol has received relatively little attention. Why do you figure that is?
Well, relatively little critical attention,
right.
Certainly grand popular attention. But the reason that I think it gets so little attention in by the critics is, well, for one thing, it's short. Mm-hmm. For another thing, it compared to his other massive works. For another thing, it's so good-hearted, some of the books are tougher in the way they proceed and in the way they end. And I think that the critical establishment just naturally migrates toward the larger, more complicated, to be honest with you, sometimes the downbeat works in a person's oeuvre. And I think that's a large part of explaining it here.
When did you start? When did you first become interested in A Christmas Carol? And were you surprised at how important this a role this played in Dickens' life and in the way he came to came to write, I guess, the way it changed his career so much.
I was very surprised. Listen, I had studied Charles Dickens and some of those so-called more important works in graduate school. But nobody ever talked about A Christmas Carol in graduate school either. So when I ran across a note at Christmas time just a few years ago and saw these contentions, I know that Dickens was broke when he conceived of the idea for A Christmas Carol. Did I know that no one was interested in publishing it, that he had to spend his own money to self-publish it? And did I know that Christmas was a sort of second-rate holiday at the time that he set out to write his little book, as he put it? And the answer in my case was no, I didn't know any of these things. And the more I looked into it, I thought, this is fascinating stuff about one of the seriously discussed works of Dickens, and perhaps the most popular of his works. And a story that's never been told before. I thought that would be a good one to work on.
Yeah. At the beginning of the book, you set out what it was like to be a debtor in the early 19th century in London. And you write about Charles Dickens' father, John. He's a 37-year-old naval pay clerk, father of seven. And it's interesting you say that he was – it's not as if he didn't have a job. He was gainfully employed, as you said, just not gainful enough. And you write about the process that a person went through, because it seems like there were these kinds of steps if you found yourself in debt. Talk a little bit about that, because this experience, of course, is profoundly influential on Charles Dickens.
Well, I think it was the signal experience in Charles Dickens' life, seeing what happened to his father, who at the time there were debtors' prisons. You could be put in jail for owing money to someone. In this case, it was for bread that Dickens' father had overextended himself and owed the baker £7, couldn't pay it. The sheriff came and took Dickens' father away. It was a great calamity, as you might imagine. In fact, the entire family was put behind bars, and only Dickens stayed out of prison because he got a job in a boot blacking factory and was able to help pay down the debt.
He's 12 years old.
Yeah,
they had him working in this crumbling factory house, 10 hours a day, pretty grim, I guess.
Oh, the light was terrible, and so he would do his work mixing the chemicals and so forth near the window where the light was better. And so he's doing this one day and glances out, and quite often people would stop outside on the street corner to watch what was going on inside, almost like watching zoo animals. And he looked and did a double take, looked again, and there was his father out strolling about the street there, having paused to watch his own son inside the bootblacking factory. It was a moment that, Dickens never saw a psychiatrist about the matter, but we can speculate what would have been discussed if he had.
Well, you say in the book it sort of put his childhood to an end. He didn't really have much of a childhood after that, I suppose.
He worked. He was in and out of school for the next 4 or 5 years, and finally was apprenticed as a law clerk, and from there went on to become a journalist. And his sketches of daily life, usually the underbelly of London society, were finally collected in a book called Sketches by Boz, published anonymously originally, that suddenly changed everything for Dickens. And almost overnight, he became a literary force in his world.
Which brings us to 1843. Let's talk about what was going on in his life when he wrote A Christmas Carol. He was only 31 years old. That came as a surprise to me. I'm not sure. I guess I may have known that. But he was awfully young.
And if you see a picture of what he looked like at the time, you know, we have this vision of Dickens as an old graybeard. And you see him as he was then, a dashing Johnny Depp sort of character.
Right. But, of course, he was at a pretty low point in his life. His critical reputation, you say, was in a shambles. His bank accounts were overdrawn. I get a sense his marriage wasn't going well either. It was, and you even talk about that he was actually giving up on writing fiction altogether in some way.
It crossed his mind. He had, after Sketches by Boz, published five works of fiction, the Pickwick Papers, Oliver Twist, Nicholas Nickleby, The Old Curiosity Shop, which was, and all these books being published in installments, weekly installments, being picked up at the rate of 100,000 copies, 100,000 issues per week. A quarter of the literate population of the entire country were snapping these things up. And then he, well, not only did he spend wildly, but he miscalculated on his fifth book called Barnaby Rudge. It was a really, well, to use an appropriate term today, a turkey. it was dry and didactic, and readers hated it. Where they'd been buying 30 or 100,000 copies of Old Curiosity Shop per week, the sales plummeted to 30,000 copies, and below that of Barnaby Rudge. And then he was asked to go on a publicity tour of the United States, and he loved the thought of this and thought he could be wildly successful in the United States. And he wasn't much liked personally in the United States. That rough and tumble place found him a little fussy and too much of a little Lord Fauntleroy. And the whole trip was a disaster, and he came back depressed, and his agents, when he talked about the next book, they said, "Well, I don't know, Dickens. Maybe let's just reissue some of your great successes." And this angered him. He thought that he might be washed up. Hard to believe from this end of history's telescope that a man of Dickens' stature could be so desperate at the time. But he was. Yeah. He felt like his time might have come and gone.
Yeah. Which brings us to October 5th of 1843. Let's talk about the evening of this fall evening. Dickens is one of the speakers for a fundraiser, and he's traveled from his home in London, some 200 miles, to the city of Manchester. And he's on the bill to speak at this fundraiser. I'll have you talk about it if you will. I mean, he is, even though he seems to be on the verge of being washed up, he is, as you say, the world's first true celebrity of the art. So he was here to speak.
Oh, yes. His sister had talked him into it. She lived up there with her husband and was involved in this fundraiser and said, "Please, Dickens, you keep promising me you're going to do this." And he finally gave in and took the train up there. Now, mind you, Manchester had a reputation that, well, if it wasn't in hell, it was certainly at the outskirts. You could see it from there. And he didn't in any way want to make this trip, but did.
Yeah. As he stood on the stage that night, you say Dickens was troubled about how his good fortune had turned on him. And you ask this question: as he prepared to step onto the stage, could he really put all of that aside and rally an audience? So let's talk about what it was that the audience was expecting from Charles Dickens that night. Because it's interesting, you talk about how today when celebrities make their opinions known about politics, it can be by, you know, kind of annoying or seeming out of place. But you say that the Dickens and other, I guess, sort of celebrity figures like him, it wasn't uncommon for them to talk about the social conditions of the time or politics. And in some ways, I guess the audience was expecting that.
Well, that's right. He in Manchester, he was still big in Manchester. Perhaps the critics in London had turned on him and were finding him yesterday's news. But the rank and file all around the country still thought, particularly working men, thought that Dickens, whose novels combating the twin evils of ignorance and want, gave people hope that, in fact, something might be done to better their lot in life. And he was passionate about it. And he held back nothing. And, of course, some critics find that the novels, some of the novels get melodramatic and strident because of that. But certainly the people who crammed into that hall that night to hear him speak were, he was like the he was being welcomed home as a Super Bowl champion, let's call it.
Yeah, it was interesting. You write about how in Dickens' day, the novel was seen as more than just a piece of entertainment, that it was a source of information and enlightenment. And the audience wanted to hear what a writer would have to say about it on a stage.
Well, there wasn't television. And journalism also was truly in its infancy. And the sketches that Dickens had produced, illuminating some of the pockets of poverty, the lack of any interest in government, certainly in combating in welfare, social welfare of any sort, were eye-opening to people because, in large part, because they were so vividly drawn.
Yeah.
And he was like television. As I say, he was being read by a quarter of the population who could read on a weekly basis.
Yeah. You read about how, charitable work for the poor was done by churches and private organizations for the most part. And sometimes you say these organizations were guided by questionable motives or questionable methods. And I guess Dickens found it kind of distasteful that charity was connected to religions, because in some ways he saw it as they were trying to sort of force people into pious living by giving them, bread and soup.
He was happy to have a hand from religious organizations, but he was adamant that children would not have to sing for their supper. He thought that there should be public education. At the time, one in three children in the entire population attended school.
So his philosophy is important, because you write about this in the book, his philosophy about social justice. You point out, though, it's important to say he wasn't a radical and he wasn't a humorless reformer. Here's how you put it in the book. You said he sought in all his zeal a society in which the pleasures of life could be enjoyed by everyone. Talk a little bit about the philosophy that's kind of informing the way he's thinking as he's preparing to give this speech.
Well, that's quite an idealistic notion, isn't it?
Yeah.
But Dickens truly believed it. Having come up from poverty himself and having had firsthand experience in what it does to a family, and having tasted a bit of the fruits of his labor in a society that was more enlightened, and having had food on the table regularly, he said to himself, everyone should be able to enjoy what I've had a taste of. And he saw that the twin obstacles toward the achievement of this idyllic society were the elimination of what he saw the twin scourges, ignorance, the need for education, and the alleviation of poverty. And it was the obligation of those who had money to give back. Now, he wasn't programmatic. He didn't adopt tax code with percentages and so forth, but he very much believed that those who had a moral obligation to give back.
Mm. Was it some version of, it takes a village? Was it some version of that?
Well, I think that he saw that if there were a universally educated society, it would by nature be a better society.
Yeah.
That those who were educated not only would be able to fend for themselves, but also that if there was a universal understanding of what was right, of what he considered to be, moral rectitude, that it would just happen in large part. He was, as I say, an idealist, and you see, I think you see it no more clearly than in what he laid out in A Christmas Carol.
Yeah. I think it was interesting to me when you write about the conditions, economic conditions of of Manchester, for example, made me kind of relate it to the economic conditions of today. I mean, you talk about how unemployment in the mills there was around 15-20% and wages were dropping. And so that's sort of the context you know, where he's talking about all of this, people were in need. That brought, for me, it brought sort of the current conditions to mind, and I'm wondering if sometimes that plays out in these stories. You know, you kind of think about your own condition in all of that.
I think we continue to be inspired by Dickens' vision. I think that's why it is the single most adapted work of fiction on stage and in screen to this day. Because people are still, in the end, struck by it, despite the number of times and the iterations in which they've seen it. There's something undeniable about the bedrock principles that Dickens puts forward here in such a vivid way that people simply don't seem to get tired of it.
Les Standiford is joining us. He's the author of the book, The Man Who Invented Christmas, How Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol Rescued His Career and Revived Our Holiday Spirits. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol, and not just the story itself of Ebenezer Scrooge and the Christmas ghosts, but the story behind that story. Dickens wrote this piece in 6 weeks, at a time in his life when his marriage was on the rocks, his career and his finances were faltering. The writer Les Standiford is our guest. He's studied this history. He says, A Christmas Carol not only changed Dickens' life, but has reinvented the way all of us celebrate the holiday. The book is called The Man Who Invented Christmas. So we were talking about the speech that he gives in October, in the fall of 1843. And the point wasn't just the speech. You said it was, you know, 15 minutes, and I'm not sure how it was received. I'm sure it was fine. But it was after the speech that's really the crucial time. When he's walking around through the streets of Manchester and he comes upon this idea for a new work, talk a little bit about this, because there's a reading I want to have you from your book. Talk about, I guess he's wandering around and this is when he becomes inspired.
Yes, the speech went over so well that I think it moved Dickens in a way that he never expected that it would. After all, he'd delivered a version of the speech many times before. Mm-hmm. But I think, given the fact that he was so tender emotionally at the point, and I think every artist probably has those rough patches where you're ready to pack it in and where you're almost, you feel underappreciated. Geez, look at all the good work I've done and no one cares. I think there was a little of that going on in Dickens, too. And yet he found that people did care and maybe the matter of running off to the continent that he was considering there to become a travel writer, and he would show them if they didn't want to read his books anymore, then he wouldn't write any. He was almost at that point. Maybe that wasn't the way to go. I think that's where he what we're leading up to.
We should, to set this up, we should mention that we know what he was thinking in part because of a letter or letters that he's written to a friend. His friend Forster, which he'll refer to in this section. Read this piece, if you would, Les Standiford.
Sure. With such thoughts and the vision of his rapt Manchester audience crowding his mind, Dickens strode about the drizzling streets of the city, debating the proper course of action. Indeed, a lesser individual might have packed it all in and fled to blessed anonymity on the continent, where he would have found sufficient work writing travel pieces to keep a cottage heated and bread on the table while he wrote books that would be good for an ungrateful public, whether they liked them or not. He would not have been the first artist or the last to suspect that he deserved a better reception. But Dickens was just not good at what he did. He was the very best of his time, a man whose powers had at one point delighted 100,000 of his countrymen each week. Was he really going to walk away from all that at the age of 31? What actually happened that night was extraordinary. As his letters to Forster would make clear, Dickens began to take stock of himself in a way that any accomplished and acclaimed writer would find extremely difficult, much less the most famous writer of his time. And yet he forced himself to confront hard truths. Perhaps it was not them, the jealous critics and the fickle readers, in whom the fault lay. Perhaps he had let his disappointment with America in particular, and with human nature in general, overwhelm his powers of storytelling and characterization in his recent work, Barnaby Rudge. Perhaps he had simply taken it for granted that an adoring public would sit still for whatever he offered it. Perhaps he could still get a point across and write a book of which he could be rightfully proud. Most important, perhaps there was a way to do so without browbeating or scolding or mounting a soapbox. Perhaps he could get them without their knowing they were got, if he could only find the way.
And so he walks there in Manchester, yeah. and he goes back home in London, and he walks, and he walks, and he walks. And I guess the story begins to take form and take shape.
As Forster, his agent, his attorney, said, until that story, the nugget of a Christmas carol, began to overtake him, in Forster's words, with a strange mastery, it seized him. Mm-hmm. It's one of those remarkable things that sometimes this is inspiration.
Yeah.
Incarnate.
What was the first image that came to him? Do we have a sense of when did he first conceive of Ebenezer Scrooge, for example? I mean, what were the first inclinations he had for the story?
I think that the primary image was of two children who, in their abject nature, in their abject appearance aspect, would symbolize ignorance and want.
Right.
And I believe he thought that by personifying the scourges of society in the form of two pathetic-looking children, he could get people to care. Mm-hmm. Not so much think about, but emotionally respond. And he had the idea of Ebenezer Scrooge, and the name came from squeeze, and at the time it meant to squeeze, as if to squeeze blood out of a turnip. Mm-hmm. It's come to mean a miser in our days, but he thought of a miserly man, named him aptly, and wanted to come up with a series, some other world, and he thought it would take an otherworldly experience to make a man so set in his ways change, to make the leopard change his spots. And that's where the ghosts came in. And of course, the members of the cast who engage our sympathies to this day and our feelings are Tiny Tim and his father Bob, and the family of which the poor crippled boy is a part. And I think from there, then Dickens began to write in a frenzy. It all took shape. Mm-hmm. And you can see the original handwritten manuscript is held by the Pierpont Morgan Library in New York. And they put it on display every season. So that and I've been there, watched families troop in and watched fathers hold their children up. And they say, look, here it is, the book that we watch every Christmas. Really quite amazing. And the kids' eyes grow wide looking at a manuscript, for heaven's sakes. And it's heavily edited. Mm-hmm. But as you say, it was written in a burst, because when Dickens conceived of the idea, it was late October, and he knew this book had to be finished, printed, distributed to stores in less than two months. Mm-hmm. And how was he going to do? He had to write in a frenzy, and he did. He did almost nothing else for that time. But you see in all the editing that went on that he wasn't careless about it, that he must have been worked like a man possessed.
Yeah. And, of course, he presents this idea to his publishers, and it kind of falls flat. I mean, they were unenthused, I think, is how you put it in your book.
Oh, in essence, it was a ghost story about Christmas. Dickens, lie down until that urge passes.
Right. But he was so excited.
Christmas was, as we say, a middling holiday, and Dickens... His star was on the wane, and it was such a nutty idea in the publisher's sense that they really wanted nothing to do with it.
Mm.
Dickens was furious at this stormed out of the meeting and told Forster that it didn't matter to him if these guys couldn't see the value of the story. He would take what little cash he could get his hands on and publish the book himself.
Yeah. This was an exercise in vanity publishing
you talk about.
And he seems like he went all in. I mean, he oversaw the design of the illustrations and the advertising. And as you say, he would be responsible for the costs of the book's production.
He became a one-man publishing show. Now, of course, it didn't hurt that he'd had some sense of what was successful before.
Yeah.
He knew the workings of the publishing business. He wasn't like someone who'd never been there. So that certainly helped him. But not only did he have to do all this, and he had almost no time to get it done. And the first thing, of course, was to get the book written.
Yeah. You say that the story of Scrooge, or the story anyway of his nephew, Fred, didn't come out of nowhere. You talk about – Fred, of course, talks about how Christmas was the one day of the year when people open their hearts and they think of others. And you see in some ways a lot of people see Dickens himself talking there. He loved this holiday, even though, as you say, and we'll talk a little bit more about this, even though people – as you said, it was a middling holiday. Did people really, in fact, as Fred says – open their hearts at that time? Or was this a fantasy? I'm thinking of Bob Cratchit and his family celebrating their meager Christmas, and Fred and his family celebrating their Christmas, and the stories from his past. Was this just a fantasy, or did people in fact celebrate like that?
Christmas was celebrated,
sure.
But Dickens was a big holiday guy. Any holiday would be good for him, because he sensed that at a time when work was set aside for whatever purpose, whatever the holiday might be, Boxing Day, which took place a couple of days after Christmas, where the tradition was to box up.
Right.
For well-to-do families, would box up the clothing and the food that they didn't or felt they didn't need or they could spare for their servants. That was the big holiday of the time. But for Dickens, a holiday was an opportunity to to focus on goodwill among men, set aside getting and spending for a day, and think about the eternal verities that really mattered. So he thought that, and Dickens had published holiday stories before. He'd published a story, a Christmas story, a story that some see the beginnings in the tale of the transformation of a cynical gravedigger who's visited by a spirit much like one of the ghosts who so troubles Scrooge. And that guy was transformed as a result of his experiences with this otherworldly creature. Well, Dickens thought if he combined that notion, if he had it happen to Scrooge on the eve of this holiday that Dickens thought should be a monument to giving, that he thought should be better known than it was, he'd have the perfect package. He would be writing a story about a conveniently motivated holiday that hadn't been done to death, let's put it. So was there some calculation in Dickens' mind? Well, of course. But on the other hand, look what happened. It worked. His instincts were right.
So there's the ghost of Christmas past, and in the scene here, Ebenezer Scrooge's fiancée tells him that she says, "You fear the world too much." You write about that line, how some people see it as Dickens expressing his own fears and his own doubts. Do you agree with that? Do you think that's where he was going with that?
Oh, yeah. I think there's a lot of psychologizing that you can do. You can see the man on the page. He wears his heart on his sleeve in his fiction, and it's pretty clear that he's talking, that he sees himself in this scene. Mm. I don't think there's any doubt about it.
Right.
He doesn't see himself as Scrooge, but again, that's part of the triumph of the book for those who would say, oh, this is just really simple-minded melodrama. You come across these the passages such as that where there's really some intricacy of emotion being dealt with, and that's what I think keeps the story alive.
Yeah. I want to play a section from the story itself. But say something about – sort of put that his writing in context, because you say in the book A Christmas Carol is sometimes seen as his most perfect work, and you talk about how it's exquisitely crafted.
Well, there's not a wasted word in it. The principle of economy is use every word you need, but not one single word more.
Yeah.
And, of course, part of what's to account for that is Dickens didn't have time to waste either.
Yeah.
Nor did he have this is the first book that he wrote that was not serialized. All the other books had been written in installments. Chapter one came out in week one, mm-hmm. and so on through 39 or 42 weeks until you had a book, which was in turn then published in a single volume. This is the first time he wrote a book that was not serialized along the way. And I think that forced him to be a tighter writer than he had been times before.
Well, let's go to this reading. It's we should talk about one element of the story. This is during the tour of the Ghost of Christmas Present, and at some moment in the experience, Scrooge notices what seems to be this claw poking out from beneath the ghost's robes, and the ghost pulls back his robes to reveal these two emaciated children. It's that boy and that girl, Les Standiford, that you were talking about earlier.
I think this is the moment in Dickens' mind that the whole story was building to.
Mm. Here's an excerpt from A Christmas Carol read by the actor Jim Dale.
From the foldings of its robe it brought two children, wretched, abject, frightful, hideous, miserable. They knelt down at its feet and clung upon the outside of its garment. "Oh, man, look here, look, look, down here," exclaimed the ghost. They were a boy and a girl, yellow, meagre, ragged, scowling, wolfish, but prostrate, too, in their humility. Where graceful youth should have filled their features out and touched them with its freshest tints, a stale and shriveled hand like that of age had pinched and twisted them and pulled them into shreds. Where angels might have sat enthroned, devils lurked and glared out menacing. No change, no degradation, no perversion of humanity in any grade. Through all the mysteries of wonderful creation, has monsters half so horrible and dread. Scrooge started back, appalled. Having them shown to him in this way, he tried to say they were fine children, but the words choked themselves rather than be parties to a lie of such enormous magnitude. "Spirit, are they yours?" Scrooge could say no more. "They are man's," said the spirit, looking down upon them, "and they cling to me, appealing from their fathers. This boy is ignorance, this girl is want. Beware them both, and all of their degree. But most of all, beware this boy, for on his brow I see that written which is doom, unless the writing be erased." "Deny it," cried the spirit, stretching out its hand towards the city. "Slander those who tell it ye. Admit it for your factious purposes, and make it worse, and bide the end." "Have they no refuge or resource?" cried Scrooge. "Are there no prisons?" said the spirit, turning on him for the last time with his own words. "Are there no workhouses?" The bell struck 12.
as the ghost throwing Scrooge's own words back at him there. Do you yeah. think, let's stand to forward, that this scene, if you think about all of the plays, all of the musicals, all of the television programs, it seems like this scene is an afterthought if it's included at all. Sometimes people strip this part out. And when you talk about the fact that this was the essence of the story, this was the thing that got him started, I wonder if that bothers you.
Oh, I understand it. I think that it's very difficult to pull off, pull something to picture that.
Yeah.
It's the difficulty that dramatists and filmmakers have. The beauty of the scene is that you as a reader are permitted to draw it, and it's despite all the words that Dickens used, you still get to draw that picture, paint that picture of those two children for yourself.
Yeah.
And the minute somebody takes that opportunity away from you and says, this is what ignorance and want looks like personified, that's a tall order for any visual artist to measure up to. And it points up the essential difference, finally, between the power of reading and the power of film. It's a scene, I think, where imagination plays such a big part. Mm. And once you try to picture it on screen or on the stage, you're taking away the audience's right to participate in something they'd like to see for themselves.
Les Standiford is with us. He's the author of the book, The Man Who Invented Christmas, How Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol Rescued His Career and Revived Our Holiday Spirits. We need to take another brief break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio, back now with the writer Les Standiford. We're talking about his book, The Man Who Invented Christmas, How Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol Rescued His Career and Revived Our Holiday Spirits. And I wanted to ask you about where did he get the ghost of Christmas yet to come? This really frightening creature, that hooded face who glides like a mist. Do we have any idea where that came from?
Well, that's the creepiest of them all, because you see, suggestion plays so much a part there, even visual suggestion, because you don't necessarily need to see what lurks behind that hood in that deep shadow. Oh, that's where you imagine. By this time, your imagination has been primed to run riot by Dickens, and I don't know where he got that from, other than, I suppose, his sense that the unknown is even more frightening than the fully figured. You know how they, and if you've seen in some of the most successful film adaptations of Made Hay over that vague image, the rule of thumb when you make a horror film is you keep the monster off screen for as long as you possibly can, because the viewer's imagination is going to be better than anything you can come up with to figure it, to detail it on screen.
Yeah. Well, gosh,
I love that character.
Yeah, I mean, no, I
he's,
do too.
He's my favorite.
Yeah, is it? That's great. The reaction to the book is had to have been an incredible relief for Charles Dickens, because the stakes were so high for him, I guess, for this book. But it wasn't a gradual reaction to it. I guess it was immediate. It was a hit.
Oh, it was published less than a week before Christmas. All 6,000 copies that were on the shelves, it disappeared immediately. The critical reception was uniformly over the moon. Even his old nemesis Thackeray penned the opinion that it would be a crime to utter any reservations about so magnificent a work. It meant everything to Dickens.
Yeah. And of course, another part of your book is talking about how really it changed the holiday for the rest of us, revitalized these forgotten customs. And it's also interesting, you say the story gave what you call a kind of a secular component, or counterpoint, I guess is how you put it, to the story of the Nativity. What do you mean by that?
Well, Dickens distrusted organized religion as he distrusted organized politics. He felt like so many organizations devolved into a certain self-serving form. And he worried about that. And he's been faulted, of course, by some who feel like you should not have that the family of the Cratchit family replaces the Holy Family in Dickens' vision almost. And I don't think that he set out to supplant the Holy Family, but to him, the Cratchit family was every bit as important because they were real and human and of the moment. And he wanted to set Kant aside and say, look, ignorance and want exists in our society, and we must do something about it. It is your duty to do something about it. I'm not sure in the end, as when you talk about Uncle Tom's Cabin, how much did Uncle Tom's Cabin have to do with the end of slavery? How much has A Christmas Carol done to eliminate ignorance and want in our society?
Yeah.
I'm not sure, but it certainly inspires everybody to want to do something about it.
Yeah.
Although some say that, that's the problem with inspirational literature, that the urge to want to do something is good enough for most people. They feel bad and they feel earnest for a few days, and then they forget they saw A Christmas Carol until next season.
Yeah. Did it surprise you the impact this story had on our traditions, on popular culture? Because it seems like, again, as you say in the book, it really transformed the way we came to think of Christmas. It kind of moved up.
Well, I thought I knew everything. I thought I knew A Christmas Carol from forwards and backwards and everything about it until I began to trace the actual number of film adaptations, dramatic adaptations, the number of little things that in society that changed the fact that before A Christmas Carol and its conclusion where Scrooge sends the urchin out to buy the biggest turkey in the butcher shop, for the Cratchit family, the tradition was to have a Christmas goose.
Yeah.
Well, in fact, goose farming in Great Britain suffered a terrible decline following the first publication or the success of A Christmas Carol. And turkey raising became enormous and continues to this day. And Christmas trees and Christmas cards and on and on and on followed, devolve in the wake of Dickens' creation.
Yeah. You mentioned there were no holiday lighting extravaganzas before that, no plethora of midnight services. There were services, of course. I guess I should point that out. And people did, as you say, celebrate Christmas, of course. It wasn't as if he literally invented Christmas. But this story really changed the way people thought about the holiday.
Oh, it did. And on both sides of the Atlantic, Washington Irving had written in the United States Christmas stories that took note of the season. But that was, it didn't have anywhere. In Germany at the time, there was a little more interest in the holiday of Christmas. But even there, it was not the end all and be all. The great Christian holiday was Easter, far and away the most important holiday in the season. And at one time, of course, Christmas was seen as a pagan holiday, actually dismissed by Protestant church leaders.
Yeah. Well, he's 31 years old when this story comes out, and he had yet to write a number of masterpieces, among them Great Expectations, A Tale of Two Cities. So what effect did this have on his literary life, do you think?
Well, it just reinvigorated him. It gave him some money, and more important than that, restored his confidence. And I think from that point on, Dickens never looked back. He would eventually divorce his wife. That created some concern. People talk about was he really a good guy at heart and so forth. He was certainly human, but as an artist, he continued in triumphant mode until his death.
Yeah. Let me ask you this finally, less than a minute. He would write, I think, 4 more Christmas books, but I guess nothing really lived up to A Christmas Carol in that way.
No. Hey, how often can you catch lightning in a bottle?
Right.
He certainly tried, but even he admitted that in the end, while well-intentioned, none of them ever held up to the original.
Les Standiford. He's the author of the book, The Man Who Invented Christmas, How Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol Rescued His Career and Revived Our Holiday Spirits. He joined us today from a studio in North Palm Beach, Florida. Les Standiford, thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, listen, I'm a great holiday guy myself. It's a treat to be able to do this and
Good.
Talk about the story.
Thanks very much. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our theme music is composed by The Moth and the Flame. Our thanks to Taylor Almond. Radio West produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.